Hello and welcome to the last Asia Pacific for 2007. I'm Adam Connors. Coming up on the show, Pakistani electoral officials to decide on Tuesday whether to postpone a general election scheduled for January the 8th. Pakistan's president blaming Al-Qaeda for the assassination of Benazir Bhutto. And China announces that Hong Kong will not attain universal suffrage by the year 2012. But first to Thailand, and authorities in the capital Bangkok are on alert as two hotels in southern Thailand were targeted in a series of bomb blasts this morning. Police say there were five blasts and dozens of people were injured. The blasts occurred in the town of Sungai Klok on the Malaysian border. Police are concerned about a possible repeat of last year's New Year's Eve when three people were killed in bomb blasts in the capital. A short time ago, I spoke to the Assistant Commissioner of the Royal Thai Police Force, Lieutenant General Pongsapa. What is the latest information coming out of the southern provinces?
Well, after the meeting this afternoon with coverage from other units, we were happy to say that we have no indication or any sign that they're going to have something happen tonight at the countdown party or at the event, that most of the people will go out and have fun tonight.
So the blasts in Narathiwat province haven't raised the threat level in Bangkok?
Tonight we can call it a big operation from the police and other unit that we can get together. We can make sure in everything that we think is improper to prevent most of the incident.
The threat on the capital this time last year was quite well known beforehand. Are there any distinct threats to the capital this year?
Most of the capital area, we deploy most of the police and special units. So we make sure that the thing that used to happen last year party is not happening tonight.
What preparations have local police put in place leading up to tonight's New Year celebrations?
Yes, first of all, we put the area in strictly limited. The area is not open last year because last year we opened all the area, but tonight we will strictly, and we search every inch in the of the area to prevent all the things that we use to make explosion or whatever. And after that, before the people get inside the party area, we will search and we will make sure for everyone to make sure that everyone that's go in is safe.
Assistant Commissioner of the Royal Thai Police Force, Lieutenant General Pongsapa, on the threat level in Bangkok for New Year's Eve following today's bombings in southern Thailand. To Pakistan now, and electoral officials have held an emergency meeting and will decide tomorrow whether to postpone a general election scheduled for January the 8th. A senior government official, however, has told the AFP news agency the vote will likely be delayed several weeks. Meanwhile, Benazir Bhutto's eldest son, Bilawal Zardari, will assume his mother's position as the head of her Pakistan People's Party, which has announced it will contest the Pakistan elections.
The party's long and historic struggle for democracy will continue with renewed vigour, and I stand committed to the stability of the federation. My mother always said, democracy is the best revenge.
Bilawal Zardari declaring that he will follow his mother, assassinated on the weekend, into politics. His father, Asif Ali Zardari, will be co-chairman of the party and will run it on a daily basis until the 19-year-old finishes his studies at Oxford University. The party of another former prime minister and opposition leader, Nawaz Sharif, initially responded to the assassination by announcing a boycott of elections. It has now announced that it will also contest the elections. And as rioting over Ms. Bhutto's death continues, the family has refused to allow an autopsy on her body and has called instead for a United Nations inquiry into her killing. Karen Percy reports.
The grief is deeply felt. On Friday, as Benazir Bhutto was being buried at her ancestral home in the southern province of Sindh, supporters gathered in Islamabad. It was part protest, part lament. They shouted slogans against President Pervez Musharraf. They could see the president's home. They could see the parliament building. But there was no chance they were going to get any closer, not with a wall of police officers in riot gear in front of them. I'm standing in the park in Rawalpindi, where Benazir Bhutto delivered her last campaign speech. Not far from where I'm standing is where she was assassinated. There are still election posters up. I can see a large image of Benazir Bhutto, several in fact. And there's the image of her father, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, who 30 years ago almost was executed in a spot not too far from here. A group of men is at the park in the cold of the early morning. It's clear they want to talk to me.
The terrorism is increasing day by day, and the Pakistani president and the government is unsuccessful to control these conditions, and we are badly affected. Our business has been affected. Our life has affected. So we demand that there must be peace in Pakistan.
There's been anything but peace in Pakistan since Benazir Bhutto died. There's been rioting and looting. The worst of the unrest has been in the country's south, Ms. Bhutto's heartland. But even in Islamabad, the city of 500,000 bureaucrats, intellectuals and military men, the anger and sorrow was in full display. For several days, most of the highways leading in and out of the city were empty, but for a handful of men dragging flaming election banners, banners from the pro-Musharraf forces, of course. Across this city, buildings have been burnt. The glass frontage of this bank in Rawalpindi is now on the footpath after protesters, most of them poor, attacked what they saw as a symbol of the country's problems. Around the corner, we come across a large group of policemen conducting raids in the neighbourhood. As a fire burns nearby, they drag out two men and put them into a van. Then they move on to the next laneway, looking for those who are instigating the trouble. Soon after, a helicopter joins the search. It is a strange scene, with chaos all around. There are moments of normalcy. A horse and cart and its human cargo makes its way through the streets. And the mosque puts out its usual sunset call to prayer. Despite the plumes of smoke rising into the air across the neighbourhood, some of the locals are engaged in one of their favourite passions, flying kites. From the rooftop, there are about a dozen of them aflight. Perhaps their owners are oblivious to the chaos below, or perhaps it's their way of escaping and forgetting.
Karen Percy reporting from Islamabad. Pakistan's President Pervez Musharraf is blaming al-Qaeda for the assassination of Benazir Bhutto. But analysts say her death has exposed massive weaknesses in the government's security capability and the extent to which military rule has weakened the country's institutions. Europe correspondent Jane Hutchin reports.
A week before Benazir Bhutto was killed, at least 50 Pakistanis died in a suicide attack on a mosque in the northwest of the country. The outgoing interior minister, who was in the congregation, was believed to be the target. He escaped. It was one of a spate of attacks in the past 6 months aimed at leading figures, anyone involved in the campaign backed by Western governments against Islamist militants. Hussein Haqqani of Boston University's Center for International Relations was a former political advisor in Pakistan. He said, apart from remote tribal areas, there isn't widespread support for the militants.
They have essentially historically been supported and nurtured by Pakistan's security services, which saw them as allies in their war against India and subsequently in their war of trying to gain influence in Afghanistan. Now they have gone out of control, but that is their real strength.
From bases in the lawless border regions, al-Qaeda and pro-Taliban militants have unleashed a stream of suicide bombings and violence, responsible for more than 600 deaths in the past half year. author Joshua Hammer.
The number of suicide attacks in Pakistan, not just along the border, but throughout the country, in Islamabad, Rawalpindi, Karachi, have grown tremendously. So I think that the army is losing that battle.
Some commentators believe that military rule has weakened the country's institutions, so that events such as Benazir Bhutto's assassination simply create more fragility. Hussein Haqqani of Boston University has advice for Pakistan's Western backers.
The most important thing for the United States and other backers of Pakistan is to recognize that the Pakistani military and the intelligence services are not the solution to Pakistan's problems. They are the cause of Pakistan's problems. And the reason why Pakistan is so poor is because Pakistan invests more in its military than it does in its people.
But John Bolton, the former U.S. representative to the United Nations, believes the threat of major instability confronting Pakistan warrants international backing.
It's very unstable, and I think historical judgment here requires that you look at a situation like this and say, when you are on the edge of chaos, potentially, what do you do to pull back from the edge?
John Bolton. The other issue, of course, is that Pakistan is a nuclear power, and there are grave fears this capability could fall into rogue hands. 6 years after Western powers waged the multi-pronged battle against Islamist militants and enlisted Pakistan's support, progress would appear to be painfully slow.
Jane Hutchin reporting. You're listening to Asia Pacific, coming to you from the studios of Radio Australia in Melbourne. Former Guantanamo Bay inmate David Hicks, who was released from an Australian prison on the weekend, is obeying the terms of a control order set down by the Australian Federal Police. Former Foreign Minister Alexander Downer says he has no regrets about his handling of the Hicks case, saying the convicted terrorism supporter had committed acts of evil, and it was essential that he be restricted by a control order after his release. Lee Sales reports.
The Federal Police and the South Australian Government claim David Hicks poses a threat to the community and needs to be closely monitored. His family, lawyers and supporters argue that's not true. Very few people have had close access to David Hicks since his arrest in Afghanistan in late 2001. One of those who did was a Muslim US Army chaplain, Captain James Yee. Yee was based at Guantanamo Bay during 2002 and 2003 and left the Army controversially after being wrongfully accused of spying. He was Hicks's only human contact during a lengthy period when the Australian was held in solitary confinement.
David Hicks was someone that I saw on a regular basis. We had started classes on how to properly recite the Quran. He often wanted to talk to me about personal things that were going on inside the prison.
Did you get the impression that he was a true believer in Al-Qaeda's ideology?
None whatsoever. I saw no indication that he was even extreme in his general beliefs. His beliefs mirrored mine with regard to believing in one God, praying five times a day, fasting during the month of Ramadan. As an American soldier wearing the U.S. Army uniform, as a U.S. military officer who met with him on a daily basis, you know, we had a personal relationship. He treated me with respect. I treated him with respect.
Now that David Hicks is free, from what you know of him, do you believe that he would pose any sort of threat to society?
None whatsoever. I mean, I'm reading this stuff that he was trained in these terrorist training camps, but I'll tell you, any American soldier who has gone through basic training has had 50 times more training than this guy.
When Hicks was released on the weekend, he made no attempt to hide his face from the media and, at least outwardly, appeared calm and composed. In a statement read by his lawyer, he said he didn't feel strong enough to speak to the media but would have more to say at a later stage. Before the release, his father, Terry Hicks, said the statement would include an apology. But it didn't, and Terry Hicks was asked about it.
He said yesterday that there would be an element of apology in his statement. That doesn't appear to be there. Does he feel like he has anything to be sorry for?
I don't think so. Yeah, you've got to realise that David's done 5.5 years pretty tough. And I think that's he's done his time for whatever. Nothing's been proved of what he was supposedly have done, so... He's done his time, and it's time for him now to settle down.
When Terry Hicks says there's no proof, it's correct that the allegations against David Hicks haven't been tried in what most lawyers would consider a credible court. But there's no doubt that David Hicks was in Afghanistan with al-Qaeda and the Taliban before and after September 11. Hicks himself has admitted it in interviews with the federal police, in letters to his family and friends, in his plea deal at Guantanamo Bay, and it's been confirmed by witnesses who were there with him. What we don't have proof of is whether he was just a lost soul hankering after adventure or a true believer on the path to becoming a terrorist. Only Hicks himself can answer that question, and for now, he's saying nothing.
Lee Sales reporting. To Hong Kong, where China has announced that the special administrative region will not attain universal suffrage by the year 2012. The announcement from China's Standing Committee of the National People's Congress came after Hong Kong's chief executive, Donald Zheng, submitted a report requesting elections in 2012. Beijing plans have outraged pro-democracy leaders and activists who are demanding an earlier date for democratic reforms. Their frustrations spilled onto the streets on Saturday as they staged a protest march through the former British colony, as Girish Solani reports.
Ever since Hong Kong returned to Chinese rule in 1997, residents and politicians have been looking forward to achieving full democracy by the year 2012 as part of China's one country, two systems principle. On its part, China has always promised that someday it would ultimately allow Hong Kong to directly elect all of its leaders and legislators. But their hopes for 2012 were dashed after China said it may allow Hong Kong's leader to be directly elected only as early as 2017, and for its legislators in 2020 at best. Beijing's decision sparked an outcry from Hong Kong's Democrats and pro-democracy activists, who say China's announcement on democratic reforms are too vague and stopped short of providing a clear deadline for attaining universal suffrage. On Saturday, more than 1,000 activists held a protest march through the former British colony. Democrat and Legislative Council member Emily Lau was among the demonstrators.
If you look at the documents of the central government, it does not mention that universal suffrage in 2017 or 2020 must be given to you. There's no such thing. When we look at it, we're very worried.
Hong Kong's leader is currently chosen directly by an 800-member Chief Executive Election Committee, mainly consisting of members loyal to Beijing. That position is held by Donald Tsang, who has praised China's announcement as the most important decision for the future of the former British colony.
I'm sure any such arrangement will be a fair and open one, giving everybody a chance to participate, to vote, and to be elected.
While many in Hong Kong have expressed their disappointment with the delay, locally based political commentator Steve Bynes says that residents will continue to back their current chief executive.
At the moment, they will, I think, give him the benefit of the doubt, because on paper, it could well be the case that this is a tremendously significant decision and will move the process of democratic reform forward. Having given the benefit of the doubt, and I'm sure that that is the majority view, there will be a very rapid onset of disillusion if it turns out that what was announced yesterday is really just another set of delaying tactics.
He says there are those who stand to benefit from the delay in democratic reforms.
The obvious beneficiaries from the delay are the entrenched establishment in Hong Kong, which is basically a coalition of the leaders of the biggest businesses here, the traditional pro-Beijing groups, who used to be a fringe movement but are now very much center stage, and of course the existing bureaucracy, because at the moment, as matters stand, the senior civil servants, that is, effectively act as ministers as they would in a democratic system. So if you're going to change all of that, all of the old establishment is threatened with loss of position.
With mounting frustration and anger from the delay, Steve Bynes expects more large-scale protests in the coming weeks and months.
I think that's almost certain. The demonstrations at the moment are relatively small-scale. And as I say, really, the level of the response very much depends on how this is going to pan out, and that's not clear. But remember that in Hong Kong, you've had monster demonstrations of people in favour of democracy. I mean, much bigger in proportionate terms than you see in practically any other place in the world. So there is a potential there It's a very large protest action.
And he remains uncertain as to whether Beijing would set about a clear deadline for Hong Kong to finally achieve universal suffrage.
Beijing has pledged that indeed there will be universal suffrage, there will be a fully elected legislature. So, in theory, that should be implemented at some time. But the way it's being presented is like a sort of, well, this is an aspiration, we're not ready, we're not ready, we're not ready. So it's very unclear when the situation turns from being an aspiration to being a reality.
Political commentator Steve Bynes, handing that report by Girish Sorlani. The Cambodian government is considering a Spanish company's plan to create a hunting park in the country. The Madrid-based safari company wants to use 100,000 hectares of jungle in northeast Cambodia for hunting wildlife. Although some say such a project will bring a range of benefits to Cambodia, others believe it will do more harm than good. Steve Holland reports.
For $38,000, big spenders can join NSOC safaris in Africa for 2 weeks and hunt elephants, buffaloes and a range of other species. The company has been operating hunts in Cameroon for 30 years. Now they're hoping to do the same in Cambodia. Mark Gately is based in Cambodia and works for the Wildlife Conservation Society. He says safari parks can be environmentally sustainable if they're operated under the right conditions.
The key thing is you need to have very detailed information on variables such as the population size, population structure, growth rates and so on, so that you can monitor the impact of the hunting on the wildlife that's involved.
Tourism is now a major earner for Cambodia, and high-priced hunts for foreign tourists will mean more cash for the country. Mr. Gately believes the extra money could help to protect the country's wildlife.
It is possible, for example, for these operations to provide a significant amount of funding for conservation activities in the area. So, for example, I mean, these companies are often, it's obviously in their interest to protect the wildlife in the area that they're operating in, so that, you know, there's actually something there for their clients to shoot.
Deputy Director of the Wildlife Protection Office of Cambodia's Agriculture Ministry, Danny Chiang, says 30 types of animals, including deer, wild boar, reptiles and birds, could be shot for sport if the plan goes ahead. But he says tigers would be protected. In Africa, where hunting safaris continue to attract wealthy adventurers, environmentalists remain opposed to killing animals for entertainment.
The negative press they've received in recent years has been quite disgusting.
Nick D'Souza is the World Society for the Protection of Animals Regional Director for Africa.
There are pictures of young cubs being maimed by the actual hunters, by their dogs, by the negative impact of them having had their mother killed, the pictures of them having their cubs, particularly in one case where a litter of cheetah cubs was exported on a private jet to Saudi Arabia and all ended up dying.
Mr. D'Souza says there are no positive benefits that can justify safari hunting.
It's inherently cruel in that there is no way to humanely kill an animal from a distance. Error will always creep in, and the animal is very likely to suffer extensive injuries that will not be killed off immediately.
It's hoped that if the park opens in Cambodia's Ratanakiri province, money brought in by the hunters will benefit poor people in the area. But Mr. D'Souza says his experience tells him wealthy companies offering safaris rarely fulfill such noble promises. And while Mr. Chiang from Cambodia's Agriculture Ministry says setting up hunting safaris in Cambodia fits with the government's plans to diversify options for ecotourism in the country, the government must also consider the negative consequences.
Steve Holland with that report. And that's all from Asia Pacific for the day and the year. For all of the latest audio and some of the transcripts from today's program, go to radioaustralia.net.au/AsiaPac. And from everyone here at Radio Australia, have a happy and safe new year.